to my life.
Hello and welcome once again to the Cinephiles, where we will be concluding our deep exploration of Brian De Palma's Scarface. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing instructor in Los Angeles, California.
Hello, everyone. My name is John Roca. I'm a writer, producer, host, and voiceover artist here in San Diego, California. And Steve, I can't believe this has gone into four parts. There's so much action in this movie. I didn't think it would drag into four parts, and I didn't anticipate that we would have so much to say about this movie. So I want to say right off the bat, thank you to all of our listeners and even some of our people who are new to the show for putting up with us dealing with this film for four parts. And I hope we've entertained you and you've enjoyed the process because I get sensitive when we move past three parts. Certain films demand it. Other films surprise us with it, like Sideways did earlier this year. When it went multiple parts. So I just wanted to put that out there before we wrap up our conversation and our exploration of Scarface.
So it's funny that you mentioned this because what people don't know is, A, I always try to cut down all of our shows as short as I possibly can make them. It's not like we're just being self-indulgent or that's not our plan. But the thing, this is where I've kind of come to on the Cinephiles, which I don't know that I've said it to you quite in this way, but I've kind of gone like, you know what? I feel like we are doing the exhaustive soup to nuts exploration of whatever film we're doing, which means that however long it takes, that's how long it takes, you know? So I'm cool with it if the conversation is good. And I've certainly enjoyed this conversation. And I really hope everyone who supports us on patreon.com/thecinephiles as well as Apple Podcast is enjoying the conversation because you are what makes the Cinephiles possible. So thank you all for that. And if you haven't checked it out, you can listen to our Cinephile shorts, which we do every single week, as well as get ad-free versions of the show. And there's a great community on Patreon that you can join, as well as our advisory board. So I would recommend checking it out.
Absolutely. And, you know, we just recently did a review of One Battle After Another, which I thought was a fantastic conversation. I know a lot of you have been really pushing us to break our 10-year rule numerous times over the last 10 years, almost 10 years we've been doing the show. But our reviews are as close as we're going to get to breaking that for right now. Maybe that'll break down the road. So if you haven't listened to that, I would highly recommend you all listen to us go back and forth. It is a spoiler conversation about One Battle After Another. I think it's one of the most fun conversations we've had about a recent film, that we've done there on the short. So definitely take a look at that. And another way you can support the show is to, when you hear the sponsors during the ad breaks and you hear about a product that you want to try out, please remember to use our code. It is so important to use our code because it lets them know that this is a place they can come and keep supporting with their ad dollars, and you all will get a benefit from it, from trying out their services or their products and see if they work for you. And we've heard from a number of people throughout the years who've really enjoyed some of the sponsors and their products, who have used them and gotten great discounts in trying them out. So please remember to do that as well. And with all that out of the way, Steve, now it's time to dive back into the world of 1983 Scarface. And where we left off, we just had this emotional couple of monologues from Tony Montana there, talking about being the bad guy, talking to Elvira, talking to Manny. And now we're going to New York City. And Gutierrez, this is the gentleman that they are essentially been tasked by Sosa to kill, is parking his car as Tony is watching him. This car is a 1972 Citroen DS21. Does that mean anything to you, Steve? I'm not a car guy. Does that mean anything to you?
Well, it's the weird French car. I mean, that's what it means to me. And it definitely was in the late 70s. There was a while where Citroens were, you know, starting to find their way into the U.S. and then they pretty much disappeared. And you almost never see them. But I think it's a cool looking car. That is my entire opinion on that vehicle.
Well, you know who wants to make this car disappear? It's Alberto, who is sneaking underneath Gutierrez's car, plants a bomb underneath it. So now we've got this laid out. We know that Tony Montana and his crew are watching the car, and the bomb has been placed underneath it. We cut to daytime, and Tony is telling Manny to keep Sheffield out of things. He's on the phone with him and checks in to see if Elvira has called. Steve, this is going to be one of many moments throughout the last part of this movie where Tony is checking in to see if Elvira has called, and she does not call once. It is legitimately the last time we see Michelle Pfeiffer either on screen or over the phone in the film, was this restaurant scene that we just talked about at the end of part three.
I have a question for you about this.
Okay.
So he's talking to Manny.
Yes.
Now, we know, because obviously we're going to spoil everything on the Cinephiles, that Manny, really right about now, is about to go away, or maybe already has gone away, with Gina to get married.
So. Yes, I think so.
So my question for you is, how long has that, how between when there was the time in the car and she said, why don't you date me, until this moment, what happened?
Clearly, Manny broke and started seeing her on the side. And then they, in some, I think, break in logic, decided that they would get married and that somehow that was going to make things okay with Tony, because in a way their relationship is legitimate and he's making an honorable woman out of her, as Latino might look at it. And which I think is such a phenomenally stupid decision by both of them. Especially Manny, who is older than Gina. Manny should know better, and he knows Tony's temper much more than Gina, because Gina hasn't seen him in 10 years, you know?
Yeah, I mean, this is really crazy. I mean, Manny is so stupid. I mean, and the way they do it, it's the way, so that's why I wanted to bring it up at this moment, because it's happening right now.
Yeah, it is, yes.
Like, right now. Well, and I do think, you know, like, I wonder about the bathtub scene and the restaurant scene, because those are sort of the strongest scenes where Manny is there. Right. And so, and I think those have to have an effect, but to me, I mean, this is, it's again, it's why I, what's going to happen with Manny totally works. We'll get to it obviously, but like, it's also where I go, I just can't believe Manny is this stupid. I mean, like Tony is a completely out of control psychopath. He's the one who knows that the best. And yet right at this moment, as Tony is in New York doing something that Manny has no idea what it is, where he's about to go to jail and tensions are really high, Manny decides this is the moment.
Yeah.
I mean, this is just, I just wanted to clarify that what's going on.
I think this is great, because like, we have to do a little bit of headcanon here. It's like, well, is Manny thinking that Tony is going away? So Manny is going to run things with Gina. And as I said earlier, in parts, there's something about Gina to me that feels like she would have taken over the business if Tony was incapacitated, murdered, or possibly imprisoned. So is Gina the one driving this marriage and this relationship coming together? Because remember, Tony says to Manny in the bathtub, you're not going to deal with Cytobomb because you focus on women way too much. So it may just be that Manny is, because Gina is such a strong-blooded woman, it may be that Manny was a bit cuckolded here and pushed in the situation, because Steve, he doesn't radiate brightness throughout the whole movie. He's a good man. It doesn't mean he can't also be stupid. And so I think there's a possibility that might have happened. But again, that's all headcanon, not factual, just all in my head, that that's a possibility here. You know?
Honestly, I find your headcanon way more interesting than what it's in the movie, because you just created a much more of a character for Gina than she is. Like, oh, like, I don't think there's, to me, there's really no evidence in this movie that Gina is as smart as Tony, or that Gina has any of the ability to become what you want her to become.
Right.
But if she did, and if you actually saw the Gina manipulating Manny into getting what she wanted, that would be super dramatic and interesting.
I think
but they don't show it. It's not there.
They don't show it. And I think maybe they felt, but then again, I mean, Oliver Stone's not really known for writing great female layered characters.
True.
But like, maybe they felt that if they showed that, it would take away some of the innocence that Tony feels for Gina near the end when she gets killed. So I don't know, maybe. But so let's get back to the movie, Steve. Tony gets into a 1983 Ford LTD Country Squire. Yes, I looked this up, with Chi-Chi, Ernie, and Alberto, who is in the passenger seat now. Gutierrez comes. Oh, well, let me ask you this, Steve. Chi-Chi and Ernie, why does it take Chi-Chi? I mean, these are two of the least intimidating guys he has in his crew. And let's tell the truth about this crew of people that he has. They're all super unintimidating. Nick the Pig, Ernie, Chi-Chi, these are not the people you want standing with you. Manny, definitely, but none of those guys radiate like dudes who can actually handle a situation. You know what I'm saying?
Frankly, they're like his posse. You know what I mean? Like, these are the hangers-on. You know, in other words, like, there are movies about gangsters where you see the muscle and you're like, oh, man, you know, like Luca Brasi, that guy is muscle, you know, a scary, scary dude. These are guys that happen to be, you know, buddies with Tony and Manny at various times, and they've gone along, you know, like that's how they feel. And so, no, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me why these guys are up here.
Yeah, because Sosa's guys are way more vicious and brutal
than
Tony's guys, for sure. Well, Gutierrez comes out of the building, and Alberto, in damn good Spanish from Mark Margolis, by the way, tells Tony that they are going to kill him in front of the United Nations and that he has to stay 30 meters behind him as they tail him. And Steve, Tony is not happy with any of this. He's snorting coke while he drives, much to Alberto's chagrin, who apparently has a code of ethics when it comes to pulling off a murder here. And they watch Gutierrez.
I think he has a code of professionalism.
Yes, right. Fair enough.
It's not about ethics. It's about you don't snort cocaine on a hit. You know,
we are professionals here, Mr. Yeah. Montana. But by the way, Mark Margolis speaks some fantastic Spanish, Steve. And I went in deep dive trying to find like anything with it. But he's a Jewish guy from the Midwest. I don't know where he learned to speak Spanish as well, but it's amazing.
Never mess with the Jews from the Midwest, man. We'll figure it out. Clearly. Not Will. I'm a Jew from the West Coast, but whatever.
He speaks better than freaking Al Pacino does, for God's sakes. Anyway, they watch Gutierrez pull his car around, and now we see, and they're wondering why he's doing this, and then we see his wife come out with their two little girls to get in the car with him. And this pisses Tony off.
Hey, no fucking way. That's it.
In one of the rare moments in this film where he speaks Spanish.
Obedece. Matamos este tipo solo. Sin mujer y sin hijo.
He says they have to kill Gutierrez alone and not with his wife and kids. But Alberto is having none of it, Steve, and says if Sosa says we kill him now, then we kill him now.
I wish this worked for me better. It works okay.
Wow, I love this moment. Wow, interesting. Go ahead. Yes.
Here's the thing. I mean, it's like, well, and but it's also, this isn't really my movie in a lot, in all sorts of ways. And this is kind of it. It's like, yes, there are two moments in the film. One where he sits with the kids, when Manny's macking on the girl, and the other when he tells Elvira that he wants kids.
Right.
And those are the two plants to tell us that Tony cares about something.
Yes.
But it's just the level of, you know, we've never seen Tony back away from anything ever. And now he's losing it about this. I am not saying that I want Tony to kill kids or that I want to see kids killed. That's not my point. I just don't have it. And again, it goes to if Tony had any kind of ethical, like if there was any sense that he was really doing this for mm-hmm. his family, or if he was doing, you know what I mean? If there was yeah. anything there, then someone who is, again, these are my kinds of stories. Someone who has some moral reason for doing what they're doing and slowly descends into doing worse and worse terrible things until they come up against a thing that is finally too far and brings them face to face with the lack of ethics and everything they've done. That's kind of what they're trying to do here, except it isn't really, because Tony's been a horrible person the whole time. And now this one place, which again, I don't want him to kill the kids, it bumps. Right. I don't have the emotional reaction that I feel like you're having for the scene, yeah. you know?
Well, because it humanizes him, because you want to cheer for Tony. You want to cheer for Al Pacino. Yeah.
That's actually the difference. I'm sorry to interrupt, yeah. but like, I don't.
Right,
that's
exactly.
the difference.
Yeah. The movie is played so that you cheer for him, even though he does these things, because he doesn't kill anybody who is innocent. He doesn't. He kills people who are part of the business, right? And The Godfather did this, right? When he says, like, we're not going to sell drugs, I don't want us to do that because that's going to affect kids. It destroys families. Like, there's these kinds of weird disconnects that some of these old mafia guys had, some of these people have who are involved in crime that, like, it's weird. Like, why is that the line? But this other thing, when you're drowning human beings in acid, why is that not an issue? But, you know, killing children is. And I would also throw in the Latino aspect of it all, and I can speak from that from experience. Like, it's kids and women are seen as sure. this kind of untouchable thing, an innocent thing, and you can kill other men, but like killing women and killing kids is something that's kind of really frowned upon, you know. And so, yeah. and I also think there's an element of what I brought up in the last part, which is my own headcanon, Steve. Is I sense that he hesitated doing this, and this was giving him the perfect excuse to not do it. And try to stop Alberto from getting him to do it. Plus, he's high on coke like crazy.
Oh yeah, I mean, we cannot separate the cocaine from Scarface. I mean, there's a lot of cocaine. You helped me put my finger on the yeah. difference. I think, which is, and again, we keep going back to The Godfather. But you know what, The Godfather has a lot of, despite the fact that they're all criminals committing crimes and are perfectly willing to be violent and do a lot of bad stuff.
Yeah,
the Corleones love each other, particularly when you start with Vito. Vito yeah. loves his children.
Right.
And
right.
even Michael, he loves his father. I don't know what we can say about the relationship with Kay and or even his children or anything else, but there is a core of motivation. And obviously, Fredo loves everyone and Sonny loves his family. Like, there's no, I mean, Sonny is violent and dangerous, but he fucking loves his family.
He loves his family so much he died for it, going to protect his sister. That's correct.
There's very little love in Scarface. And the only love there really is towards Gina, which is incredibly fraught and complicated. And so there isn't that. And so, and again, and this is why when Tony says, I don't want to, I'm absolutely not going to kill kids, which I'm glad about.
Yeah.
I don't go like, oh, it redeems him a little bit because there's just been no love. There's nothing in him throughout this whole movie that makes me like him, you know?
Yeah. I think you're looking at two, you know, someone coming from a pretty terrible background in communism and all of that.
Absolutely. Someone,
but you could argue Vito, though, coming in like as an immigrant, being stuck in that room, having to find his way. Like, we skip all the formative years of Vito Corleone. We don't know what happens from when he's that kid in the room to when he becomes Robert De Niro, right? There's a whole movie or series, TV series you could do with the growth of Vito Corleone from the kid to Robert De Niro, you know? So I think that's the thing that you kind of can use as an excuse in the difference between the two guys.
Sure.
But you're absolutely right. There's not a lot of love in Tony's life, either him giving it or getting it. You know?
Yeah.
Hey, Cinephiles fans, this is Steve and John. Listen, according to the National Institutes of Health, as many as 30 million men in the United States experience erectile dysfunction. That's ED. It's more common than a bad night's sleep. Well, the good news is Hims is making it easy to get access to treatment so you can feel like yourself again without the stress or awkwardness of dealing with ED.
I mean, that's the worst part of it. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hims brings expert care right to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that puts your goals first. Hims offers access to treatment options ranging from trusted genetics that cost 95% less than brand names to hard mints if prescribed.
Yeah, and listen, we're all getting older. This stuff happens. There's no stigmas here on the Cinephiles. We love you all. So to get simple online access to personalized, affordable care for ED, hair loss, weight loss, and more, visit Hims.com/Cinephiles. That's Hims.com/Cinephiles for your free online visit. Hims.com/CINEFILES. Actual price will depend on product and subscription plan. Featured products include compounded drug products, which the FDA does not approve or verify for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. See website for details, restrictions, and important safety information. Hey, Cinephiles fans. The holidays are sneaking up on us fast. You can feel it and sense it in the air. You go to the shops, you see the Christmas decorations are already out, and we're not even at Halloween yet. So that can cause some of you to have a little bit of stress. Well, Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. Their products are high-quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the USA, and they're crafted by independent artists and small businesses. I took a look at a number of gifts here. I saw this awesome couch caddy that they have for movie lovers. It's made of this acacia wood that snakes over the arm of the chair. You can put your book in there, you can put your drink in there, your remotes in there, and sit back and relax and enjoy a movie without ever needing to get up off your couch, and it looks fantastic. Uncommon Goods has something for everyone, from moms and dads to kids and teens, from book lovers, history buffs, movie lovers, and diehard football fans to foodies, mixologists, and avid gardeners. You'll find thousands of new gift ideas that you won't find anywhere else. And with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. So shop early, have fun, and cross some names off your list today. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/cinephiles. That's uncommongoods.com/CINEFILES for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary.
Hi, Cinephiles fans. You know, sometimes when I'm prepping for a show, I get an undeniable urge for something sweet. And lately, my go-to has been Washington Red Raspberries. Now, if you've been listening to this show, you already know that Washington Red Raspberries are frozen at the peak of freshness by passionate farmers in Washington State. But what you might not know is how to make a delicious mini crumble in under 15 minutes. So here's my shoot from the hip recipe. Grab a couple of handfuls of frozen raspberries and throw them in the microwave just long enough to get them warm. Probably less than a minute. Toss in a few tablespoons of sugar, a squeeze of lemon juice, and a bit of cornstarch. Give it a taste and adjust the sweetness. In a separate bowl, mash together some oats, flour, butter, brown sugar, cinnamon, and a pinch of salt. I'd give that a taste too, but all combos of butter and carbs and sugar are going to taste pretty good. Spread that on top of your berries in a container that can stand up to air fryer temperatures. I have a tiny cast iron skillet that works perfectly. Then throw the whole thing in your air fryer at 400 degrees, and between 6 and 10 minutes later, you will have a beautiful raspberry crumble that can only be improved by a scoop of vanilla ice cream. Now, Washington red raspberries have been specially developed to be frozen, which means they can survive freezing and microwaving, air frying, and still maintain great texture, color, and flavor. And I can confirm that they are particularly delicious when eaten while watching a great film. Washington red raspberries are available in the freezer section at places like Costco, Kroger, and Winco Foods. Make sure to look for Product of the U.S. on the bag, and happy cooking.
Well, Tony reluctantly does agree with this, but judges Alberto for wanting to go through with it. And now, Steve, we're following behind Gutierrez in his car with his family as we get shots of the two girls playing in the back, which is a real, real obvious way to play to the audience's sympathy and increase the tension here. We see the bomb beeping underneath the car and how far away they are. And Tony starts to spin out, Steve, and starts talking about killing the kids.
Made you feel good to kill a mother and a kid, son. Made you feel big. Like, you big man. Well, fuck you.
And now as the tension is building, the increase in volume between the two guys is building, and the anger is building, as Alberto turns on the remote to detonate the bomb, and Tony is in full rage mode here, Steve.
It's so funny because, again, this is why I generally don't go snort a lot of coke when I'm on a hit. All Tony has to do is hit the brakes. There's right. No reason. Yeah. He doesn't have to shoot anybody.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, or he could, you could drive up real fast and shoot that driver in the head who's got the kids in the car at a stoplight. You know right. what I mean? Like the choice that Tony's about to make is bad in every way. Again, not that I want the kids to die.
Right. But again, you can't separate the coke from Tony right
yeah.
now. He's messing with his judgment. And Tony says to Alberto,
"What do you think I am? You think I killed two kids and a woman? Fuck that! I don't need that shit in my life."
And as Alberto is about to push the button to blow up the car, Tony pulls out his gun and screams,
"You die, motherfucker!"
and shoots Alberto in the head, much to the shock of Ernie and Chi-Chi in the back seat. And Tony then loses it even more on the dead body of Alberto, saying, "What do you think I am? I'm a worm like you?
I told you, don't fuck with me. I told you, no fucking kids. No, but you wouldn't listen. Well, you stupid fuck. Look at you now."
What a scene.
It is. I think we're starting to see who Al Pacino is going to be, you know, 20 years after this.
That's a great point. The screaming. Yes.
The screaming, the intense, the just like full on, like chewing the scenery stuff. And it is fun to watch. I just think about Ernie and Cheech, man. And I'm just like, it's like, it's almost like, it's like, I was just waiting for a bus and then just something happened. You know, I was just in this restaurant and then he started yelling at all the people in the restaurant. I was just, you know, he came in to meet my boss and then he shot my boss and he shot this cop and then I'm working for him. I don't know what the fuck is going on. I mean, like, I just feel so bad for these two morons who just stuck with Tony Montana as basically, because really all they were in this entire scene is passengers. That's
yeah.
it.
Yeah. Yeah. They tried to calm Tony down. They were going through with the killing of the wife and kids. Like for mm-hmm. them, they didn't have that issue. Tony did, you know, yeah. for his own reasons, right? But then again, maybe they did, but they didn't want to say anything because it was Tony. Like Tony might kill them in a way if they were to contradict Tony or whatever. So it's an interesting scene. I agree with you, but this is to me, and I know people think I'm crazy with some of my things, Steve. So I'm going to try to say this in a way that makes sense, but like,
well, I don't know if you're going to be crazy, go crazy, be full
okay,
crazy.
I'm going to go crazy. Tony and Chi-Chi are like working for a corporation.
Yes.
Where you can't, like you can't stop the madman who's in charge of the corporation. And that's why it sucks sometimes to work for a corporation or a company, because you're just the person, you're just a spoke on the wheel. They're the ones pushing the bike or driving the car. And just like here. So at times you're stuck in that kind of a situation and you have to go along with it. And so I think that's what this is a little bit of a microcosm of, even though these are murderers and it's a drug situation, you could look this at any job. There are people like Tony and Chi-Chi who are like, what the fuck? Why is the boss doing this shit? but we got to do this to keep our job and feed our families. And where else am I going to go? Without the threat of death, of course, but still.
I mean, I have worked for a few crazy bosses. I think you have too. And there are those moments. I haven't worked for this level of crazy, but I've worked for this moment. And I'm sure you've done it where your boss is saying something publicly or to someone else. And you're standing next to your buddy at work and you like, I don't want to make eye contact with them because you know, that as soon as you look at each other, it's like, what the fuck is happening?
Yeah. You look straight at the ground.
Just look at the ground.
I don't know if you'll keep this in, but I know for me, I'm not going to say the person I worked for, but I worked for a certain boss who wouldn't let us count down the top 10 Star Wars films unless we put a particular film at a specific ranking. And he wouldn't, and when we wouldn't agree to do it, he refused to let us do it as a video on the channel. I'm just going to put that out there, which is madness to me. But that person was so adamant in between his vaping that we would have to put a particular film at a particular ranking or he would not allow us to do the video, which was crazy.
I am not going to ask you to divulge. I'm not going to ask you to name names, John. This is not the House Un-American Activities Committee, but I am going to ask you what movie and what rank?
I think it was Revenge of the Sith and we had to rank it no lower than third. So it had to be in the top three Star Wars films.
Wow.
Now, for some of you, you might be like, well, that's not a big deal. I like that movie. It should be top three. But for a lot of us who were working at the time, it was absolute sacrilege to put that film above some of the other Star Wars films. And so I remember that being like a big deal for a lot of us, even the people higher up than me who wanted to do this list.
It honestly doesn't matter to me what Star Wars film it is. Telling critics, you must critique this exactly how I tell you to, is unethical in every possible way.
I'm paying your paycheck, so you will do this for this video. It was so, I was like shocked at this. I was like, how childish is this? You know, but whatever. But bosses are crazy, as you said sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, after all of this madness, Steve, we cut to Tony on the New York docks calling Nick the pig to get an update on what's going on there. By the way, this is beautifully shot. Another wonderful cinematography shot here, Steve, that's just gorgeous.
Where the hell is Smelly? I've been calling all over the place. Where is he?
I don't know, Tony. He's been gone the last couple of days. He didn't say nothing.
Been gone? What? Where? I left the fucking charge, man!
And then Nick tells him that Tony's mother has called and that Gina is gone as well. And again, he asks about Elvira and there is no update.
It's a lot in this scene. First of all, again, stupid fucking plan, Manny. This is a terrible plan.
I agree.
Second of all, it reminds me there's the scene after the motel sequence where he's making the phone call. And, you know, after a traumatic event, this seems sort of like a similar moment. And you know, he is doing all the addict self-destructive stuff. He's obsessing over his obsessions. He's not letting go. He's not in control. What's interesting, I feel, about Scarface is there is a certain crazed inevitability to Tony's descent. You know what I mean?
Yes.
And there is something fun about watching this guy go increasingly out of control. I don't mean like fun, ha ha, but it's like, oh man, if you thought Tony in Act One was scary, check out this guy as he snorts all the cocaine and is, you know, like wanted by everybody.
But let me ask you something, because I mean, you've written scripts, you know how films, you've directed films, you know how films can be constructed. Do you think Oliver Stone looked at this last part of the movie is like, I've got to remove Manny somehow because Tony won't be able to descend all the way to the bottom if I don't remove Manny? Because Manny has always been the one guy that keeps him from totally spinning out. And so, as you said, like there's the inevitability that he's going into this fiery wreck in essence of his life. Manny would have been able to pull him out. Maybe Manny would have talked some sense into him. Maybe Manny would have been able to deter it. But putting Manny with Gina, although it worked out because it's a pretty brutal scene and what it leads to, and it leads to his complete breakdown. I wonder if this was a bit of a quick fix for the situation to make it believable that Tony would spin out and go all the way down to the bottom and set himself on fire.
Well, it's definitely not an Oliver Stone thing because this is exactly what's in the original Scarface.
Oh, is it really? Okay.
100%. This, okay. So the elements of the original Scarface is young guy comes to work for, you know, mob boss, mm-hmm. starts to get bigger and bigger and more powerful. He has a sister. He has a best friend. And there's attraction between the two. And then the 3 a.m. phone call that traps the boss and he kills his boss. That's all in the original. And then this sequence of the characters that are named different, but Tony and Gina yeah. have run off to get married. He shows up at the house, shoots the Manny character. It's yeah. all of that is exactly what's in the original. And what I find, and it was, you know, those, I can totally see it because you go like, oh, these structural elements of yeah. are things that you can apply in a different location, you know, to a Cuban right. immigrant versus Italian mob and all that stuff. Right. And so, no, that's totally there. I like your headcanon better than I like what's in the movie because I like the idea that Manny is the one person that could hold Tony back. And then at this moment when Tony most needs to be held back, Manny's doing that makes perfect sense, except for the fact that Manny never holds Tony back. Mm. That's not in the movie. I mean, like he is the only person that conceivably could, because he's the only relationship Tony respects at all.
That's a good point.
But that's never happening. Manny is just always going, Tony, why are you? Oh, Tony. You know, like that's, he does that the whole movie. So like, and again, this is where I was like, if Tony had love for Manny and better relationship, and if we respect, I think this would work better for me than what is happening. You know,
I think there are micro moments, like when he stops Tony from attacking Gina in the bathroom. I think there are little moments, but Tony also stops himself in those moments. So yeah, I think you make a good point that we haven't seen Manny really stop Tony.
Yeah.
He has like at time when Tony has paused, Manny has jumped in and maybe kind of slowed Tony's anger down a little bit, but he's never like physically stopped him, you know?
Yeah.
So that's a good point you bring up. Yeah. Well, we cut to Tony's car arriving in this compound there in Miami. Nick meets him at the bottom of the stairs of this opulent red velvet carpeted home. Good God, Steve, this was an incredible design for a house. Nick tells Tony that his mom has called again, and that Sosa has been calling him every half an hour and sounds pissed. So now we've got this situation laid out. He also tells him that there's still no call from Elvira. So we're setting this all up here, Steve.
Well, and the other thing we've got, which I'm really excited about, we got a lot of coke, John. There is a lot of cocaine. Yes,
we are getting there. Tony walks into his office, answers the phone, tells his mom that he'll be over there soon, and then he snorts a fuck ton of coke, as I have in my notes, and gets on the phone with Sosa. I would think that the last person that you want to snort coke with, you want to snort coke before you get on the phone with, is Sosa. You know,
but cocaine is all about confidence. Like that's what it gets.
So I don't know that. So yeah, really? Okay.
Well, I'm sure you've read a book where someone did cocaine. Yeah, I mean, like you know, it makes you feel king of the universe.
Really?
I could do anything.
Okay. Yeah. I legitimately did not know that. I've never like explored it or researched it. I've known friends who've done it or do still do it, but I never asked them about their experience on it. Mostly because I don't ever want to try it, you know? So,
but
yeah, interesting. Okay.
By the way, and I know I said that I edit things out to keep things short, and I'll make this a short digression. I cannot tell you how many times as a teacher I had to tell my students what various drugs did. Because someone would just write a script where someone did cocaine and then fell asleep. And I'm like, look, people don't generally do cocaine and fell asleep. And that someone did a drug that clearly is not an hallucinogen and has crazy hallucinations. And I'm like, and so it became like a normal thing in my class to go, listen, people, know your drugs.
He did weed and cleaned the whole house.
Yeah. That's not that's not what it's, that's not how those drugs work. And I wasn't telling my students to do drugs. I was just saying, if you're going to write about them, you should know what they do.
That's fair. That's fair. Yeah. Tony gets on the phone with Sosa. He calls him Alex here, which I think is the first time I think I've heard that in the movie. And Sosa is clearly agitated. Go ahead. So,
you think?
Yeah.
We had a little problem.
I heard.
Yeah. How'd you hear that?
Because our friend gave a speech today at the UN. He was not supposed to give that speech, Tony.
Yeah, well, you got Alberto, you know, he's a piece of shit, you know? I told him to do something. He didn't listen to me, so I had to cancel his fucking contract.
This is nuts. I mean, like, this is the plan you came to tell? I mean, this is also why I would have just stopped the car rather than killing Alberto. But now that you've killed him, it's like this was you had several hours between New York and here to think about what you were going to say to Sosa, and this is what you came up with? Like, this is real dumb.
Yeah, you could have, like, you could have staged it so Alberto fucked up in some way.
Yeah.
I mean, you could have possibly, again, but again, Tony's not, as you've said before, Steve, Tony's not a big long-term thinker.
No,
he's not a current thinker, and whatever's going on in his mind, especially coked out of his mind, he's trying to find logic, and it doesn't make sense.
Well, and he can only go at things straight on. Yeah. So right. This guy right. fucked up. This is what, that's it. You know, yeah. There's no yeah. subtlety.
They found what was under the car, Tony. Now our friend has got security up the ass. And the heat is going to come down hard on my partners and me. There's not going to be a next time, you fucking dumb.
Hey, wait. Hey, take it easy when you talk to me, okay?
And Sosa leaves him with the warning.
I told you a long time ago, you fucking little monkey, not to fuck me.
Hey, who the fuck do you think you're talking to, huh? You want to fuck
me? And then Chi-Chi has to tell him that Sosa has hung up because he's so coked out.
I think they do a great job in this film of setting up the power and scariness of Sosa.
Yes.
Because when he says, I told you not to fuck with me or whatever that line is, mm-hmm. it's like, oh, shit.
Yes.
It does not feel, it feels like it's supposed to. Like this is completely out of Tony's league, which we're going to see that it in fact is completely out of Tony's league.
Well, I think
despite his superpowers.
Exactly. Yeah. Which we're going to find out. But what actually adds to it even more, Tony, is that Sosa is rattled. And we have not seen Sosa rattled throughout the whole movie. I mean, when he was looking at the interview, he was upset looking around the room as this journalist was talking about his organization. But we have not seen him be rattled. Yeah. So the fact that he's on the phone, a little emotional, calls Tony a name like fucking dumb cocksucker, and then later calls him little monkey, that is showing you how rattled he is. And when he hangs up on him, that's the show of power. Like, you're yeah. so unnecessary to me that I'm hanging up on you because I'm going to kill you, you know?
Yep.
Oof, it's so scary. Now we quickly cut to Tony at his mom's house. Imagine going from Sosa to your mom's house now. And this is framed so interestingly, Steve. It's like we are sitting in the other room outside of this room in the kitchen where Tony and his mother are going back and forth. It's like we're a bodyguard waiting for Tony to come out of this room so we can leave the house.
So this is a technique that I learned in film school is described as a surface division, which is that you essentially, our frame, which is a rectangular landscape-oriented frame, but then you create a new frame within the frame, which is now this vertical frame of the doorway. And that creates sort of a different sense of space. And I think part of what this shot is doing is it creates a sense of separation. Like this is in a private space. There's something between us and them. There's something intimate going on. Like that's kind of the feeling this sort of shot gives to me.
It almost makes us feel like we're not allowed to be privy to this. Like we're not part of the family.
Therefore, totally.
You know what I'm saying?
She got a place of her own. She don't tell me where. One night I follow her in a taxi and she goes to this fancy house in Coconut Grove.
Hey, Wolf, where'd you get that kind of money?
You!
And Tony's like, I don't give her that kind of money, Mom. And she says, yes, you did.
One time, $1,000 you gave her.
So clearly, Steve, Gina did not listen to Tony about how to dole out that $1,000 that we saw an hour and a half ago in the movie. She used it on herself and then made a big show of it, which kind of tipped off her mom, I think.
It doesn't surprise me at all that Gina was not able to keep that $1,000 from her mom, who seems very smart and very perceptive. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't surprise me. So clearly, by the way, and was Tony giving her money this whole time?
I think he was taking care of her, but I don't think he was giving her like that kind of money to buy a house on Coconut Grove. I'm sure he was sliding money to her because something tells me that business probably wasn't doing that well because she's not really we don't really see how skilled she is as a businesswoman, you know?
I mean, it would be insane if mom didn't know that Tony was somehow supporting her because we've seen her in new dresses, new outfits. She's going out. She has her own business. Like, of course, I mean, like that's a, but then there's this also thing that, but then there's this other thing is that at some point Manny started dating her. We don't know exactly when. And so some of the money and some of the stuff that has been happening could have gone from Manny.
Okay. Was the guy with her?
I don't know. There was this car in the driveway. I know if I go in there, she'd kill me. She's like you.
This is where I get my headcanon from. She's like you. Okay, where's her place? Where is it? And she tells him that it's 409 Citrus Drive. And now his mom grabs at Tony out of anger and sadness and begs him. He says, you got to talk to her. And she says, Antonio, which I think is a really important thing. using the proper name is something, you know, within the Latino community. That's like a legitimate, like,
sure.
I really got to get through, you know?
You got to talk to her, Antonio. She don't listen to me. Okay, she says to me, Mira, shut up. Mind your own business. Exactly like you do to me. Ever since you came back, she's been getting this way. Why do you have to hurt everything you touch?
On your
Why
way!
Do you have to destroy everything that comes your way?
So it's a really powerful indictment from mother to son here, Steve, in this back and forth.
So you're not going to like what I'm about to say.
Okay.
I don't buy this scene. I don't believe mom. I don't believe mom goes to, I mean, this, the first scene with mom is she hates Tony.
She does.
Like,
yeah.
Wants nothing to do with him. Why doesn't she go to 409 Citrus Drive?
She said, because Gina will kill her. She says this. I know if I go in there, she'll kill me. She's like you.
Does she mean actually murder her?
No, but, you know, verbally berate her, maybe get upset, maybe get mad at her, maybe physically push her away. Something like that.
I needed more check-in with mom to believe that she's going to turn to Tony in this moment. The first time I see her, she hates him, doesn't want anything to do with him. Get away from my house. You embarrass me. You embarrass all the Cuban people. You are what's wrong with everything. And the second time we see her, please, 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 I can't talk to my daughter. Go see it. I don't buy it. It doesn't, it's not enough for me, you know?
That's great. Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough. The show is always open to subjective interpretation of these scenes, you know, as we said.
I'm sorry.
No, please don't apologize. I think you have a right. And there might be people who are listening to us who feel the exact same way. So I appreciate you offering that point of view. But for me, this has always worked because there is a mixture of love and hate that is involved sometimes in the relationships between mother and sons. And I can only speak from the Latino point of view. I've seen this. I've seen this where mothers have like talked so much shit about their sons and then are begging them to do something for them or to help them.
Oh, I'm sure. Absolutely. Of course. I'm not saying that never happens. Of course it does.
Yeah.
Totally.
I buy it because at the beginning I could, like, when she sees him, when he shows up the first time in the doorway, she almost stops herself from being somewhat happy to see him because she knows the danger he brings. And then as things escalate, you know, she tells him to get out because she's embarrassed him and all the things. But here she's desperate because she loves Gina. And the only person that could bring Gina back to her is Tony. So this is a tactic I think she's using in a desperate emotional state to try to convince Tony to do this. But again, that's how I see it. And I totally respect if it doesn't work for you. As we've said, it's not your movie. And I just feel this one
totally
in a different way. And it's totally cool. But Tony rips himself away with a coño, which has been a great term we've seen in this movie multiple times, and walks out as she yells after him, malagradecido, mal hijo. And I tell you, there are two words in my experience growing up that if you were ever called this, it was as bad of a word as you could be called. And desgraciado is one of those words, and malagradecido is the other one. Mm. And so for me as a Latino watching this, when she says this, it is a curse. Like it's almost like just a cutting off of him from her. Because she initially asks him to help, but then she realizes, like, you know, that he's the sole reason why all of this happened. And so in a way,
you know,
it's a destruction of their, it's a, her way saying it's over forever, you know?
You know what? Hmm. That is a big part of why you like this. This scene works better for you than it does for me. Because I didn't know what those words meant.
Yeah,
I had no
context. Yeah.
I didn't know the Spanish. And so that moment makes it make more sense to me with the first introduction of mom than it does without that.
Yeah. For those who don't know, who don't speak Spanish, malagradecido means ungrateful. It's used to describe someone who shows a lack of appreciation for kindness, favors, or gifts they've received. Now, that seems a pretty innocuous meaning, but in Spanish, it carries much more weight, that word. There's a context to it that's pretty much a slicing of the relationship between two people. Tony gets in the car with Nick and Ernie. Again, these are not the big best bodyguards.
They're passengers. I'm going to stick with their passengers.
On the worst ride ever. And tell him to drive to 409 Citrus Drive.
By the way, there is, I think there should be a Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead of Nick and Ernie.
With Chi-Chi occasionally.
And with Chi-Chi popping in. Yeah.
That's actually fucking genius. Oh my God. That would be great. So Tony tells him to drive to 409 Citrus Drive as Ernie tells Tony that he can't find Manny. And we see Tony do more coke as he stares out at the houses that in Coconut Grove. Steve, why even have a shot like this? Why not just cut to them arriving at 409 Citrus Drive? Why do we need to see Tony doing coke? Why do we need to see the houses reflecting in the reflected in the window as the car is driving? What is the logic of a shot like
this? Well, let me give you two different answers. Okay. One answer, I think, is that 409 Coconut Drive or Citrus Drive. One of them, I think, is that 409 Citrus Drive, it is in a very affluent white part of town.
Oh, good point.
This to me looks like establishment success America that he's driving into. So that's probably the reason I would get. And of course, doing more coke, they really, really, really wanted you to see Tony Montana do an insane amount of cocaine. That is part of this movie. But the editor in me says, I don't think you need this shot. I would cut it out. Like, I think this movie, one of the great things about Brian De Palma, who is not my guy as a director, is he loves the tension build. He loves the sustain. Yes. He loves the slow, methodical. And like I said, particularly for me in the train station sequence in The Untouchables, it works fantastically well. Yeah. I, as an editor, am always impatient. I always want to see how much can I cut it down, you know? Right. So like to me, it's like, look, this is a 2-hour and 45-minute movie. At this point, I'm like, let's move it along, you know?
Yeah. I like your first explanation that this affluent neighborhood. And I'll tell you, as an editor, I totally respect the second explanation, which makes sense. But I think the first explanation is interesting when you think about headcanon. Like, Manny has always had a better approach to everything than Tony. Tony has always wanted to show off, right? Manny is much more patient, and Manny wanted to become like a high-end, good-looking guy who could ingratiate himself into a white neighborhood. Like, Manny was built to be in a white neighborhood. He's so good-looking, skinny, strong, young. He's got that affable energy. Easy. Tony is the dangerous one in a white neighborhood. And so he wants to build out his mansion to be this gaudy thing, because to him, wealth is worth. And so he has to show it off, right? Manny is much more, let me be one house in a string of similar looking houses, but in a house that has status, you know? So I think that's why he has that house in Coconut Grove. They pull up to 409 Citrus Drive. Tony gets out and rings the doorbell. The door opens, and as he walks through to the next door, he knocks on it, and who opens the door? It's Manny. Tony has accidentally found Manny, Steve, in this moment.
Dude. Manny, what the fuck is wrong with you?
Why'd you buzz him in?
I mean, Jesus. I mean, like, you know Tony is a dangerous person. You don't answer the door in the robe. Like, you knew this was like a move. You made a move, and you thought it was going to work out. Okay, fine. But this was your, I mean, like, what the fuck is wrong with you?
I 100%
agree. And then Gina showing up on the stairs above, also in the robe. It's like, come on. Sorry, it's just like, are you crazy?
There are a few criticisms I've agreed with Steve on in this movie. We've done the four parts. This one, I 100% agree with you. I do not understand why Manny answers. I mean, the last time we saw Manny talking to Tony about Gina, Tony unleashed on him with a slap and on his arm and of violence that Manny rarely was the focus of. And so it makes no sense that Tony, when Tony shows up, they don't get fully dressed and sit out in the living room somewhere. And why doesn't Manny have bodyguards who live there as well? Like, there's these little things that should have happened, but it doesn't, you know?
Let's say Manny and Gina had worked out a perfect plan. Tomorrow they had this way that they were going to tell him, and they had they worked out every detail, but Tony shows up at their house unexpectedly and they're not ready for it. So, okay. So now, first of all, if you are, you know, a drug dealer with killers all around you, and including this Tony thing, and you ran away, I'd probably look out the window first before I opened the door to see who was at the front door. So maybe they should do that. But the second problem with it is that Manny walks up and is just smiling like everything is cool. He would be scared shitless if Tony showed up at the wrong time when he had just had sex with Gina.
Great point.
And so would Gina. Like, they should be stressed out, and they're not.
Yeah. And I think it's that they deluded themselves that them marrying each other would
make
have
it all
been,
okay.
Yeah.
And then he'd be happy seeing his sister half naked with his best friend. He'd be fine with that.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Manny greets him with a smile, as Steve just said, in a bathrobe. Tony looks at him with a mixture of anger and a little sadness. But just then, in that moment, as Steve mentioned, we go to slow motion again, and we hear that dissonant sound cue as Gina appears on the balcony, closing her robe, clearly seeing her panties. In slow motion, Tony looks at Manny with disgust and then rears, just the rage in his face in slow motion as he shoots Manny in the belly. Much to Gina's horror, who now runs down in slow motion in her panties and bathrobe, and the camera slowly pans to Tony and the man we might have liked for not killing a wife and kids has just killed his best friend, shooting him twice for being with his sister.
It is a shocking moment. Yes, I have criticisms of this movie. This moment works. Even though I think that Manny's an idiot and I love the setup, this moment is so powerful and it is so upsetting. It is one of those filmic scenes where it's just... it's like you want to go back in time. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's one of those sort of like, oh, can we please have a do-over? It is so horribly upsetting, and it only becomes more upsetting in the next moment.
Yeah, it's so tragic, absolutely. Because we now jump out of slow motion as Gina is crying, holding Manny's lifeless body.
We got married just yesterday. We were gonna surprise you.
It's awful. It's so awful.
We as the audience are like, Jesus Christ, you know. Ernie comes up on Tony, tells him that they need to get out of there. Nick sends Ernie to grab Gina, who unleashes on Tony with screams of utter rage and hate and pain, and tells him how much she hates him as they take him out.
At this point, so hey, I'm sticking with our Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead because their story actually is really interesting to me. Al Pacino's completely wrecked performance at this moment. It's because you've had this person whose entire personality is based on fighting his way forward over and over and always being aggressive and always moving forward. And at this moment, he is stopped. He's broken. I think the entirety of how broken or what this is going to take some time to sink in with Tony. But even at this moment, there is no moving forward for him right now.
Yeah. Again, we have to always remember this for the people who are listening. Like, he's high on coke.
Yeah.
He's making all of these decisions whacked out of his mind on coke. You know, I don't think he would have shot Manny if he wasn't high. I don't think he would have gone to the violence place. Plus the stuff that happened with Sosa, the threat of Sosa, what happened in New York with Alberto. Like, he is carrying a lot. His mother just essentially cursed him. He's carrying a lot of weight through this coke. And in this moment, he pulls out the gun and kills Manny out of anger, because I think he senses what Manny did as a betrayal. Instead of like them having it out, fighting, maybe punching, he pulls the gun and kills it. And that is tragic on so many levels.
Yeah.
It's not tragic to be sympathetic towards Tony, in my opinion. It's tragic because this is where all his anger and his desire to achieve things has led him to this moment of killing his best friend and essentially his sister, cursing him for the rest of her life.
We're definitely into some Shakespearean tragedy level kind of emotions, I think, at this moment.
And you mentioned Godfather, Steve. Michael killed Connie's husband right at the end of The Godfather. So there's an element of the sister brother situation killing the husband. So,
well, it's so interesting because you're right. It is exactly the same sin in a way.
Same sin. Yeah. Right.
Except A, the two big differences are we totally like Manny.
Yes.
We're not a big fan of Carlo. And the other big difference is that Michael methodically made sure that he understood exactly what his guilt was and then moved forward with a carefully run plan to kill that guy. Like, as opposed to Tony made this decision in 1 second.
He did. Exactly. Yeah. That's the difference between the two protagonists, for sure. We cut to Tony's car as it drives back onto the compound, his compound, as we see this long hair figure running into the vegetation on the compound there. And this ominous music now, Steve, there's a new music cue in the film, starts to play underneath everything. And then we see more people that look just like this guy climbing over the concrete walls as Tony's car pulls up. And you don't have to be a rocket scientist to realize these are Sosa's men. But I'll go back to what Steve said earlier. Boy, they sure got there quick, Steve, like within hours.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very, very quick to do this whole plan to put an army. It's essentially an army. And yeah. I can't think of any other movie that does something quite like this, which is that we are in an unbelievably emotionally difficult moment. Like this is, you know, real tragedy, real upset. And in the midst of, we're not stopping that emotional moment. It's in the midst of the emotional moment that we see like the build of a huge action climax.
Yeah.
You know, it's really interesting because what I'm normally what you would want to feel is like, oh shit, here comes the bad guys. We're going to have a big battle. But I'm not thinking that because I'm like, oh fuck, he just killed Manny. Jesus. And here's Gina. And oh, what are those guys doing? You know, it's like, it splits you in a really interesting way, I think.
I think it's a great point you to bring up, Steve, because we just saw him. If you're following along this movie and you like this character, I know he does terrible things, but you kind of like this character, him standing up for a wife and kids, there's something positive in that you're like, okay, there's some good in him, right? But then he kills his best friend and instead of being angry at him, if you really like this guy, you're caught in a place of like, oh my God, how could you? This is so tragic. And now your sister hates you. What the fuck is wrong with you? And you're still kind of cheering for this guy. But then when you see all of these people show up, Sosa's men show up, you're just like, oh no, this is going to be fucking brutal. You know? And so it, as you said, it splits you. It yanks you in so many different directions, these sequences as we end the movie. And Tony is in a daze. Totally. Gina is walking behind Nick and Ernie as they're taking Gina, who is clearly traumatized, into the house. She even fights them to go into the house. Yeah, go ahead, Steve.
I think the Gina's realization that she is about to be brought into the home, the lair of the man who killed the man she loves.
Yeah.
Like it's literally feels like you're dragging me into hell. Yeah. Like, and because I actually think she is in a psychological place that ain't that far from hell right now. You know what I mean? And I think her performance is great in this moment.
There's only the opening scene with them in their house that is tender.
Mm-hmm.
And her, like, you know, trying on dresses or whatever. And Tony opening the place for her. But, like, he slaps her in one of the scenes in the bathroom that's pretty traumatic for her. And now he's killed her. The love of her life at the moment, right? And so there's so much mixed in with all of this, and it's painful. Tony's lost in all of it now. Sosa coming for him, Manny's death, Elvira has left him, his mom has cursed him, and now Gina is done with him. And we cut to him sitting in this state of mind, if I can read Al Pacino, the actor playing these levels, as bags of cocaine are sitting on his desk. It's a pathetic scene, Steve.
Dude, this is a lot of coke, man. Really, it's so funny because like this is this weird thing about this movie is on the one hand, it's fantastic performance from Al Pacino and dealing with all these issues. On the other hand, this is a meme. I mean, like Tony Montana and his cocaine is, you know, a very well established meme, and it is gloriously ridiculous, I guess, is what I would put, you know. Those giant piles of coke he's got, you know.
I don't think you can earn for the people that this movie works for, like me. I don't think you can earn that scene without everything you've built up to throughout the whole movie, which is at times has been, as you said, Steve, so well, gloriously ridiculous, but also pretty scary and brutal at times, and exciting and thrilling and charming. So we get to this moment. This would normally look stupid. And as you said, it's been made fun of. I mean, Michael Bolton did it on the Lonely Island parody song, which I think is hilarious. But I also think this is an element of Oliver Stone putting himself in the movie. Because Oliver Stone was dealing with a very strong cocaine addiction when he was writing this movie, as we said at the beginning of this conversation three parts ago, that he moved to Paris in order to get away from coke, as if there's no cocaine in France. To get away from coke and deal with his addiction. So the bags of coke, the depression, the self-hatred that you're seeing Tony go through here in these moments, at least what I think Tony's going through, when I look at Pacino's performance, this is Oliver Stone, in my mind, replaying some of the worser moments of his life that he's dealt as he's dealt with his cocaine addiction here on screen.
You know what it is? You got you really got two very grandiose filmmakers teaming up with Oliver Stone and Brian
yes,
De Palma.
You
know, and that, and I, you know, and like, and I, because it is like, it, we're going to go full on, you know, I'm sure like when I'm having conversations about film, I'm always like, well, of course we're not going to go full on, you know, and Brian De Palma and Oliver Stone, you team them up and like, that's not enough coke. Oh, you think that's enough coke? No, no, no. Like I bet in Oliver Stone's script, it said there are two large piles of coke, and Brian De Palma's like, we're doing three piles, you know. Like,
you seen those mashed potatoes in the Close Encounters? I want three big mounds of coke, just like that, in the middle of his desk.
What are we gonna do now?
Do? We're gonna war. That's what we're gonna do. We're gonna eat that saucer for breakfast. Close that fucker down.
They're great looks with Ernie and Cheech at
they
this
know
moment.
They're fucked, yeah, right?
We're totally fucked.
Especially when Tony sits back with coke hanging off his nose. As you said, this is gloriously ridiculous on purpose, I think. And as the camera pans past Tony, we see even more of Sosa's men invading his compound like gorillas in guerrilla warfare. And the camera slowly pans back in on Tony as he stares at the mounds of coke on his desk. And I think, in my opinion, Steve, and you might disagree, but I think in my opinion, in this moment, he is grasping how much he has utterly fucked up his life and all of it just to be the king, the drug kingpin there in Miami. Like, we saw him being reflective in that dinner scene. Is this what it's all about? Is this what you have? Is this what it leads to? And now sitting here, I think that moment is plussed even more. That feeling, that sentiment, now that he's lost Manny, Sosa's coming after him, his mom doesn't know him, his sister doesn't want nothing to do with him, and he's got Nick, Ernie, and fucking Chi-Chi as his bodyguards, in essence, in this moment. Like, I just think there's so much that he's grasping here of how utterly useless and fucked up his pursuit of power and money and how hollow it all really is, you know?
I actually think this is an incredible low point, and I think it works genuinely well. And here's my theory that I just came up with on Tony Montana, which is that he essentially goes through life saying, A, you know, I have the biggest balls around and I can push anybody or anyone who stands up to me, I'm going to destroy them. Yeah. He has that thing running in his head. And B, that I should have, that the world should be mine, you know, like, and so he lives on those things. And I think at this moment, and he's been continually cashing that check. You know what I mean? Like, he's he pushes it and he pushes against Frank Lopez. Frank Lopez goes down. But, you know, Omar's gone. The guy, the Colombian's gone. Like, at each step, and now he's coming up against Sosa, which is a whole other thing. Right. And I think what's happened in this moment is he realized it was bullshit. Do you know what I mean?
All,
the whole thing. But what I find interesting about this movie is that, yes, this is the low point. Like, this is the moment where he goes, oh my God, what have I wrought? You know, what terrible pain have I brought to these? Has all that.
Yeah.
But then at the end of the film, which obviously we'll get to, he actually becomes the platonic ideal of the vision of himself that he was putting out in the world. He's like, I mean, he literally almost becomes a superhero. And so it's really interesting that we have this low point, this reckoning, this ethical, moral thing that would be like more in a Steve Morris movie. But then we go at a certain point, fuck that, you know, say hello to my little friend. That's what we're going to get to, you know?
Yeah, because right now it's a Greek tragedy. Right? Yeah. Right now it is a Greek tragedy. But because there is a bigger villain, in essence, the protagonist, and I would say the hero, has to stand up to this villain and go out on his shield. He's a warrior. And I think if you don't have the ending of this movie the way it was laid out, which we're about to talk about, there's no way this movie has the impact it has on so many people for years to come, and on the rap culture and other cultures who just revere this movie, and that sense of badassery that this movie brings about, you know, because they all ignore all the shit that led to this moment near the end of the movie where he stands there taking bullets upon bullets at the top of the balcony. They ignore him killing his best friend, fucking over Gina, fucking over his mom. They ignore all that shit, fucking with Sosa, because he stands up at the end there and takes the bullets. And so it's a convenient deifying of Tony Montana that I think doesn't work when you really break it down, but it does work for the purposes of the people who want to use it that way. We now get these quiet shots of the compound as Tony's security is walking around it. Again, this is the worst security you could ever hire.
I mean, there's literally an army coming over the wall. Like, and I've seen it on multiple security cameras repeatedly. Yes. Like, yeah, these guys suck.
These guys are like, these doughy guys just walk around going, do-do-do-do-do. You know, and then Tony then stumbles out onto the balcony trying to get some fresh air. And then he has to psych himself up for the fight, Steve. Like, he's just got, like, he knows, like, I got to get ready. Whatever my depression or sadness about this is, I've got a fight coming. Even with through the coke haze, he realizes he's got to get ready for the fight. And almost as a perfect companion to this moment, we see Ernie and one of Tony's henchmen discussing what they're going to do about Tony as they look at him and see the state that he is in.
Well, and he's the only really good killer, as far as we know.
Yes.
It's like Tony's the one who handles all this. We don't see Ernie doing anything.
Exactly.
I mean, these guys are fucked. They're so unbelievably fucked.
If you choose to ride the coattails of someone who is much more of a badass than you are, you must also be ready to crash and burn when that badass gets met by a bigger badass, you know? And certainly I think Ernie is figuring that out here in this moment. Tony walks back into his office, sits at his desk, and then, Steve, he just breaks down over having killed Manny.
Oh, fuck, Manny. How the fuck I do that? How the fuck I do that, Manny?
And he does this great physical cue that the rubbing of the chest, I think, is incredible. It's as close as we're going to get to him saying, like, his heart is broken. Is this like reflexive move to rub his chest? I think it's a beautiful moment as an actor watching another actor do that work. You know,
I wrote that down too in my notes. Mm. There's something really, Al Pacino is one of the great actors.
Yeah,
and there is definitely we talked before about like the job of the director and the actor is to make the emotions, the internal emotions, visible, and this is a perfect example. You can see every thought going through his head. He's remembering his friendship. He's feeling the way the trigger felt when he pulled it. He's seeing the blood on the floor. He's seeing Gina's face at the moment that she said, "We got married today." He's going like, and he's in a loop, you know, he's stuck. Yep. And I think when he touches his chest, it hurts. Like this is, you know, he's feeling real physical, deep pain.
Yeah. We cut to scenes of Sosa's people killing Ernie, sadly, and other members of Tony's security team and his employees. And we see a guy throw a grappling hook up to Tony's balcony and climb up it. Now, here's a little tidbit about this scene and some of the scenes that we're going to talk about here in a second. Steven Spielberg visited the set of Scarface as they were shooting these scenes. And some of these scenes were shot by Steven Spielberg, including the guy throwing the grappling hook that we see here in this moment. Because Steven Spielberg and De Palma were good friends, and De Palma invited him to be a part of this and shoot at the time. And Steven shot some of these action scenes that we see at the end of the movie. What are your thoughts on that, Steve?
I think it's pretty cool. Well, I mean, it's so funny. We can continue to make our Godfather comparisons because George Lucas was on the set shooting little second unit stuff on The Godfather.
That's right.
So we got Spielberg on Scarface, Lucas on The Godfather. These guys are all just one big happy family.
There's a great TV series profiling these guys with actors playing these guys being on each other's head. Like if you could capture write like a 10-year period when these guys were working through the 70s into the early 80s and see how they, 15-year period, how they came to be, how they borrowed off of each other, how they were motivated by each other, maybe even jealous of each other, and then at times showing up on each other's sets to help each other. Like it would be a fascinating thing to write, Steve, you know?
So I just heard that the people who did The Crown, they might be doing a new thing on the Kennedy family.
Yes. Yeah. With Michael Fassbender as Joseph Kennedy.
Right. So what I suddenly went is you do The Crown with and you start in 1972 or something, and you come back in the mid 80s and then you come back in the 90s and watch these guys. You know, and it's Coppola, Scorsese, Spielberg, Lucas, and Brian De Palma, and what's his name? Who directed Conan is going to pop in, and
John Milius. Yeah,
John Milius is got. Yeah. I mean, you got to have John Milius. I mean, he's like a crazy wild man. Yeah. You know, Peter Bogdanovich kind of goes by, but he doesn't really hang out with those guys. Like, I think this would be so much fun.
It would be interesting, right?
Yeah. So Ernie and Nikki Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead stories. These are copyrighted by the Cinephiles.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah. Tony seems to hear the grappling hook, says Manolo to himself, and then snorts more coke. And just then, Steve, as we're like grasping that Sosa is coming for Tony and we feel this tension, out of nowhere, Gina walks into Tony's office with this almost angelic energy. She then seductively, in my opinion, puts her hand on her body and says,
"Is this what you want, Tony? You can't stand for another man to be touching me. So you want me, Tony, huh?"
You get no argument from me. This is 100% seductive. That is what's happening. And I hadn't seen this movie in a really long time. Yeah. And I had not remembered this. I had remembered some stuff, but I had not remembered this exact moment. And when this moment happens, I'm like, well, this is fucked up. Like, we've gone to a whole other kind of fucked up place now.
Yeah, I know. And I've seen some of our listeners go like, can we just lay off the incest stuff? And it's like, it's in the movie. What do you want? We talk about everything that are in the movie, that are in these movies. So well, I apologize it clearly if it bothers
is.
You all. You
know, yeah, but, here it clearly is. This isn't, yes. You know, this is not open for debate. I don't think that is what she's saying, you know?
Right. Basically. But Tony is surprised by this. And he's like, what you're talking? So for me, I have to say, I've been pushing this possibility that they might've had stuff in the past, but clearly Tony's reaction here makes you think that they didn't, right? That he had this overdeveloped sense of protection. And maybe to Gina, it reads in this moment, because she's so in a state of grief and loss, and Tony's reaction to be, and I'm sure Manny told her that Tony was not happy about his interest in her. And so maybe in her messed up mind right now, dealing with the trauma and the grief of the loss of her husband, getting murdered in front of her by her own brother, that she now goes into this psychotic place and accuses Tony of wanting to have sex with her.
What's it, Tony?
Is that it?
As she raises her gun and shoots at him.
Here I am, Tony.
And this becomes an increasing threat now with every line she speaks.
I'm all yours now, Tony, you see? I'm all yours now.
Gina.
You better come and get me now, Gina. Tony.
Tony,
come and get me, Tony. Come on. Come on, come and get me, Tony. Do it now before it's too late.
And this time, she nails him in the leg, and she's almost thrilled by it, Steve. She lets out a oh sound in this manic state of mind. She probably, this is the first man she's ever probably shot.
Oh, come on, Tony. Fuck me, huh? Fuck me, Tony.
Gina.
Fuck me, Tony. Come on, I just fuck me.
Until the grappling guy bursts in through the windows, doors, and machine guns Gina to death. Fuck, what a scene, Steve.
It's, I mean, I'm not a trained psychiatrist, but I think Gina is having some real issues. I mean, this is, it's one of the most fucked up scenes I can honestly think of. You know, yeah. I mean, it is, and I think she does it's an incredible performance on her part.
Yeah.
I think the combination of the violence and the really disturbing sexuality and everything that's been going on, I think this moment and Pacino's performance, because there's literally nothing. Like, how can you respond to this? And
yes.
The fact that she's shooting at him, and I think they do a great job that she's, I can't 100% tell if she's trying to kill him or not trying to kill him. It could be that she's trying to kill him, but she's so fucked up that she's not shooting straight. And it could be that she's trying to, I don't know. I don't know that Gina knows. Like, I think she is, you know, literally over the bend. It is a very, and the fact that the fucking compound is being overrun by an army of Sosa's men simultaneously is nuts.
Yeah. You know, it's a fact. Hey, where did she get the gun? Right.
Well, I think there are a lot of guns in this place. That doesn't surprise me.
But in her manic state, you know what I'm saying? Like her state of depression, she gets this thought that he has always just wanted me. Is that what this is? You know, like in a psychotic break, in essence, grabs the gun and then walks in and knows exactly how to play Tony by luring him in with this kind of softness, feminine, wild stuff, and then surprise so that he can drop his guard and she can shoot at him. And Tony doesn't shoot back. Like, this is important. As I said, he is not going to kill women or children in this moment.
Well, it's his sister too. I mean, still, like, yeah.
Right, still. Yes, you're right. But I also think if Elvira walked in and was shooting at him, he wouldn't shoot at Elvira. There's a thing here that...
Yeah,
that,
but he would kill women.
I don't think that at all. Oh, I don't know where...
He'd kill Marta or whatever her name was, the Colombian in that motel. He would kill her.
But he didn't.
Okay.
So he kills no women in the movie. And fair. I think there's I think they make that a thing. But that's my own opinion on it, right? So I don't know. But Steve and I like look at it differently on certain things. Totally cool. Totally believable that you could feel that way about it. But I think this is important that he doesn't, right? Because it's like, for him, it's shocked. He's shocked by what she's doing. He's also caught up in the pain of everything. And her shooting him, this to me, once again, in my mind, says to me that if things had worked out a certain way, she could have just as easily run this criminal empire as much as Tony did. Maybe even better than Tony. After this guy kills Gina, Tony then leaps up in his anger and throws him over the balcony. We hear this guy screaming as he falls to his death there. And Tony now stands atop the balcony with the machine gun and just shoots this terrible dummy that they have in the water, Steve. I was so mad at this. How is a guy not just... why don't you get a guy to just lay there? Why are you putting a dummy in the water to be shot with bullets? It's so... ridiculous, you know.
I have a theory for you, John.
Okay.
I don't know this at all. I have no facts to that this is based on. I haven't heard anything. But looking at that, I agree with you. I think it totally looks like a dummy. And I was trying to think of why they would have done it. And the thought that I had is you can see the machine gun fire hitting in the water around the dummy.
Yeah.
And to me, I don't know if there is a good way to squib in water.
Oh,
in other words, maybe. How they set the shots and what it might have been was that De Palma went, look, I really want live machine gun fire hitting all around the body. And they went, we can't think of a way to do that safely with a human in the water, because maybe they just fired a gun into the water, which is kind of what I guess they did. And that's why they chose to have a dummy. That's my guess.
What would be funny? You know what would be funny? If it was Spielberg shooting the bullets into the water.
Totally.
Yeah, don't get it twisted, people. Spielberg, I know he's a mainstream filmmaker and people love him and they think he's the nicest guy. Steve is there's a very well understood thing in Hollywood that you don't fuck with Steven Spielberg. He has got a steel spine, that guy. So don't get it twisted. I wouldn't be surprised, actually, if he shot the bullets. And this moment of Tony shooting this guy grabs the attention of Sosa's guys. And as Nick tries to fend them off with his pop gun, the man who will kill Tony, let's call him El Terminator, blasts Nick in the head with a shotgun.
This is Gino Silva.
Yeah.
He's in all sorts of things. 1941, Amistad. He's in Mulholland Drive that we talked about recently. Ooh. Tequila Sunrise is in Lost World. Again, it's this whole movie is filled with these working actors who have worked for a really, really long time.
And this guy is chilling. He was a guy. Yeah. He was the same guy in the helicopter with Omar. So this guy is a chilling guy. Tony, in his fucked up state, tends to Gina's lifeless body now, crying and kissing her, seeking solace from her dead body and forgiveness for killing Manny.
I love Manny. I love you.
And now El Terminator climbs up the rope to Tony's office, and we see Sosa's men crash the main lobby of Tony's place as Chi-Chi tries to hold them off. But there's too many of them, Steve. And as Chi-Chi bangs on the door... for Tony's office to let him in, he is shot to death from behind. A pretty brutal ending for Chi-Chi.
Tony! Coño! Tony!
I really don't think Tony ever cared about any of these guys.
I don't think so either. Except for me.
He lets him die outside. And I'm not saying he could have saved him or anything, but I don't think he's ever given a shit. I also think the thing I was thinking about, I think Oliver Stone and Brian De Palma were thinking about the end of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
That's how this feels. Because it feels like the Bolivian Army is showing up.
What happens if we actually see the Bolivian Army shooting Butch and Sundance?
Wait. These guys are from Bolivia.
Yes, they are. So this, they could be.
I mean, Sosa's from Bolivia.
Like, exactly.
I have, again, no evidence, but I actually wonder if that's why this is set in Bolivia, is they were thinking about Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
That's actually a great point, Steve. Yeah. Never thought of it once. I think that could totally work. Chi-Chi's death, though, wakes Tony out of his grief, And now he is ready to fight as he tells Gina's lifeless body to wait for it. But let's address that, Steve. What are your thoughts on these scenes with him and Gina's body? Like, is this supposed to give us more of a tragic energy, like a feeling of this guy is, he does care. He does realize he fucked up. He's talking so softly to Gina's body. Is this a one last moment to have us feel some sympathy for Tony before he's about to go toe-to-toe with Sosa's men?
It's absolutely Shakespearean. And again, this is exactly what happens in the original film. Gina does none of the sexual stuff, but Gina does come in to try to kill Tony and then get killed, you know, because Tony, the characters aren't the same names. So I think this is, and it's a really weird thing. I mean, the idea of the hero having his last moment with people that he loved and then standing up and going out of a blaze of glory is something we see in movies all the time. What's interesting with this movie is that he's responsible for the horribleness that has led to the tragedy, but then he sums up his power and goes out in a blaze of glory. So it's funny. So it's, I mean, this movie plays with conventions in really weird ways to make you feel weird things.
I am 1,000% with Tony. Like, I really am. Even with all the stuff he's done, it's because of those little moments throughout the movie, because the movie works for me. I feel sympathy for Tony, right? And he's just like, because, I mean, he's a guy from a terrible upbringing. Communists fucked him up, no father, and he's just consumed with money and consumed with status and worth. And he has an overdeveloped sense of self-importance, which all leads him to this, to all the tragic things that go on at the end, because he's not a mentally healthy person. Well, Tony grabs a massive assault rifle out of the cabinet and screams,
"You want to fuck with me? Okay."
The assault rifle is a custom Colt AR-15 with an M203 grenade launcher. Now, I'm not a guns guy. I'm not a rifle guy. I'm not a bazooka guy or assault rifle guy. So if I've said any of that wrong to those of you who are hardcore gun nerds, I apologize. But this weapon was also used later in Clint Eastwood's Heartbreak Ridge, one of my quietly favorite Clint Eastwood films, and by Schwarzenegger in Predator. So it is the same rifle. Yes.
Whoa, that is great. That is so great, because while I can't remember the particular weapon from Heartbreak Ridge, I 100% remember it with Arnold in Predator. Yeah. That's fantastic.
Yeah. By the way, if none of you have never seen Heartbreak Ridge, I highly recommend it. It's one of those quiet little 80s films that came and went with Eastwood, and he is damn good. And one of the last, like, Marsha Mason kind of roles where she's the lead in the film. And as Sosa's men gather outside the door of Tony's office...
You want to play games? Okay. I have to play with you. Come on.
And then he stands in the middle of the room, holding his rifle, aiming it at the door, and says his now iconic classic line.
Say hello to my little friend!
And he shoots a grenade out of it that wipes out a bunch of Sosa's guys, and he machine guns the rest of them to death as he calls them all kinds of names, walking out of his office.
I think I've made it fairly clear I don't love this movie. This is awesome. The last 7 minutes of this film are so ridiculously crazy and just like, okay, let's do it. It's great.
I think this appeals to, and I don't want to be sexist here, but I think this appeals to a lot of men. This idea.
That's not sexist.
Okay. Because we are like, our dads instill things in us. We see in all of the content that we consume in TV shows and movies and other media, like, you have to fight to the end. You have to go out on your shield. There's a value and honor in that. And so this idea that Tony, all the cards are stacked against Tony, but he's still willing to walk out there. And the fact that the movie has him take out a bunch of guys. So in a way, you as the audience can, like, quietly believe just for a little bit that he can get out of this situation. It adds to the legend of the character as well. As he walks out there and just unleashes on everybody, shoots people off the stairs. And then he stands there taking out Sosa's men. And he looks like a god.
You know, there's the stories of ancient warriors that would become berserkers.
Yes.
That they would go into a berserker rage. And in the berserker rage, they couldn't be hurt. They didn't feel pain. They had increased strength and speed and violence. And that's what this is. Tony has gone berserker. He will feel no pain. Until we're done, and he will keep fighting. I mean, the number of people that he takes out in this sequence is impressive.
Well, you read about people who do PCP and they almost become superhuman because they don't feel pain in the moment. But then, of course, later when they come down, it's like utter wrecks. But like, you hear those stories how drugs can sometimes cause you to be in this state of mind where you're not feeling these things. And it feels a little bit like that's what's going on, which is maybe snorting all that coke has kind of helped him. Not that we advise any of that before you go into war or battles or anything, but it seems like that's what's going on here.
No, I disagree, John. Listen, if any of our listeners have 70 or 80 mobsters coming to kill them, my feeling is you do all the coke you want.
Okay, but you might fall asleep, as some of Steve's Steve students have written before.
That's right. Don't do Quaaludes, though. Know your drugs.
Oh, yeah. Don't do Quaaludes, yeah. But Tony gets shot for the first time as he's kind of unleashing on all of these people. He falls down, reloads his rifle behind a dead body, gets back up, and then starts shooting and blowing them all up. And there's this moment where everything kind of stops, Steve, and he looks out at all the devastation he has caused, and he screams out, The movie is giving him these final moments of defiance, which has been the foundational pillar of his personality from the first few seconds of this film.
In this moment, Tony Montana becomes the ultimate version of Tony Montana. This is, he has now achieved full Tony Montana-ness.
I'm Tony Montana! You fuck with me! You fuck with your back!
Yeah, it's like a video game. It's a video
This is what it is. Is that he maxed out his power, you know, bar, and now he can use his special moves. Exactly. That's actually exactly what's happening here. He went into invulnerable mode.
And I wrote, Steve, I think it's healthy to have a belief in yourself and your ability, especially when people want to fuck you over or take away your business from you, which seems to be what's happening here.
Now I'm just
but sometimes you might not be right.
And now I'm just picturing Tony Montana in the therapy chair in The Sopranos with what's her name? and she's going like, I don't feel like you lack confidence. That's the
what you're talking about, Dr. Melfi. and then we see Sosa's men finally start to connect with Tony and shoot Tony. Now it drops his rifle and Tony stands there with an insane amount of bullets going into him. And like Jake LaMotta in Raging Bull, he stands there taking it, screaming,
I still care, huh? I think you fucking want it!
And I said this, Steve, can a person do enough coke to withstand this many bullets entering their body?
I don't know. I'll let you know after this weekend.
And then suddenly, as Tony is in, as Steve described, this berserker mode and screaming at them to keep shooting at him, they all stop shooting because they see what Tony doesn't see, which is the El Terminator guy right behind Tony. And as Tony is in full frenzy mode, yelling how he can take their bullets, El Terminator unleashes a blast to Tony's back and sends him off the balcony into the fountain. And Steve De Palma shoots this in slow motion, his shot, and he puts his arms up almost in a crucifixion pose as a stunt person falls into the water.
I don't think it's pushing it to say this is a crucifixion pose. I think that's exactly what it is. And I think, this is Brian De Palma. This is Brian De Palma's being extreme. Because he's not my favorite director, and I'm really sorry. I'd like to meet him. I'm sure he's a nice man. I know people love his films. I think there is an element with Brian De Palma of, look at how I'm directing this movie. And so the slow motion is always a little slower. The timing is, because there's such a like, and because he uses all these unmotivated camera moves, which makes you aware of the director. I feel the director here saying, check this out. Oh yeah. I put the bloody coke dealer in the water in a Christ pose and shot it in slow motion. Fuck yes, I did. What do you think of that?
Check this out, motherfucker. I also think it's a way to have the audience react to the death of Tony, because he's taking all these bullets, but this shotgun blast is the end of Tony. So maybe you're giving the audience like a moment to grasp the death of Tony. And then we see a graphic pop up on screen that dedicates the film to Howard Hawks and Ben Hecht. And we fade to black. And this is the end of 1983 Scarface.
But the thing I wonder is, what would Howard Hawks and Ben Hecht think about this movie being dedicated to them? I also find it interesting that the dedication comes up before we go all the way to black. We're still on the bloody screen, which is a little bit unusual. I don't know that they would. I mean, for its time, I mean, the original Scarface is pretty violent and intense, but I don't know that they would want this dedicated to them. I do think it is a powerful ending, particularly with The World Is Yours. I mean, The World Is Yours is like, if you didn't get it, this is, you know, the journey, the goals, the ideals of Tony Montana have led him to this terrible, terrible end.
Well, I think, again, this is Oliver Stone writing this, and he is, 4 years away from writing Wall Street? There is so much of what Oliver Stone writes as an indictment of this American ideal to pursue power, to pursue money, to pursue wealth, to pursue success at any cost. And I think this ending is De Palma and Stone aligning with that point of view, that it is an empty and hollow pursuit.
Yeah.
Even though these guys make it gloriously insane and graphic and all of that. And I think just like Coppola, they didn't anticipate that people would turn Tony Montana into a hero like they did with Michael Corleone. The film is an indictment of his point of view. The film is an indictment of his foundational construction as a person to seek this kind of stuff, because this is where it led him. It's a fascinating ending, you know.
I actually have a couple of questions from our patrons.
Ooh, cool.
So this first one is from Adam McAllister, who writes, as someone that is watching this movie for the first time, as well as the 1932 version, how close are they to the source material from the novel? It's interesting to read that the 1932 version is half the runtime of the 83 version. So I haven't read the novel. But what I think is really interesting comparing these two films is that it's the spine elements of the plot, which is the young guy, the mob boss, the betrayal, the sister, the best friend, the murder of the best friend, the end with the sister, and the showdown at the end. One of the things that isn't in the 1932 version is there's no Sosa. It's actually a shootout with the police that happens at the end. But I actually think for screenwriters out there, this is a smart thing to do, which is if structure's not your thing and you don't know how to do it, is find a movie with a tight, simple structure that you can lift a piece from, because then you can build all the other stuff around it, and maybe just no one will recognize that it's the structure. Our second question is from Sebastian, who says, okay, John, prepare yourself. Okay. He says, I might be stepping into a minefield here, but is this really a good movie? This is what I would consider a vibe movie with some terrible dialogue, badly directed scenes, and some over-the-top acting. It could be a watch with a beer or two, but then it's 170 minutes long. Now to my question.
F you!
Go ahead, yeah.
I feel like this movie got cult status, partly due to the excessive violence and the release of the VHS, but also due to it being embraced by the rap scene, where many of the lines in the movie were incorporated into the music. Can you guys think of other movies that had similar impacts on popular culture? And then he says, I may have written some bad things about the movie, but again, it's a vibe movie, so I'll probably put it on in preparation for the pod. Who wouldn't want to revisit 1980s Miami?
Yeah. Here's what I'll say. I think what Steve has been saying throughout the whole podcast is the truth. This is a movie that it's either your movie or it isn't. There is no middle ground. And for me, I would disagree with everything that Sebastian said. I think it's incredibly well directed. I love the dialogue in this movie because I've known people like this, not drug dealers necessarily, but certainly Latinos who speak like they do in this movie. The interactions that the family has, mom and son, Gina and Tony, those are very believable. And so to me, throughout the whole movie, I love the dialogue, love the direction, love the performances and everything like that. So I don't think you can say just because the rap scene gravitated to this movie, it going cult status. I think it already had cult status for a lot of people through the 80s and 90s. Then the rap scene grabbed a hold of it and it gave it another level of cult status. But it had already been either a guilty pleasure or a cult film that people loved. And remember, it did well at the box office. It didn't fall apart. It wasn't a box office failure or flop. So there was a sense of people loving this movie. And the reason it got a second life on VHS or in home video is because people were telling other people to rent this movie and watch it and enjoy it. So there's something about, you can't remove the eminently quotable nature of the movie and somehow say that it doesn't have quality. There's not a lot of films that are so quotable that don't have quality. So I think there's, that's my pushback on Sebastian's point of view, even though Sebastian is 100% valid with his own, to have that point of view from his own perspective.
So I'm going to talk entirely out of my ass for a moment, because this is not my area of expertise, but I actually think it's really interesting the huge influence this has on rap and hip hop culture. I think that's a really interesting thing. And one of the things I do know is that part of the beauty of that movement is using a lot of things from different places to essentially to sample. And so I think this character of Tony Montana, it makes perfect sense. And I can totally see why this becomes an iconic touch point for the hip hop scene. You know, that makes a lot of sense to me.
So the film was shot over 24 weeks from November 22nd of 1982 to May 6th of 1983. It premiered in New York City later that year. That's how quickly the post-production was on this, Steve. On December 1st of 1983, it was released on December 9th by Universal Pictures. It debuted at number 2 on the week of its first release, beaten to the top spot by the Clint Eastwood's Sudden Impact. The film was a commercial success. It grossed almost $70 million against a $23 million budget. The initial critical response was negative to this film due to its extreme violence and profanity and graphic drug use. And as we've said throughout our conversation of this movie, some Cuban expatriates in Miami objected to the film's portrayal of Cubans as criminals and drug traffickers. But it has been reappraised over the years and is now considered, much to maybe Sebastian's chagrin, to be one of the greatest gangster films ever made. And someone as important to the gangster genre as Martin Scorsese has praised the film. And as Sebastian mentioned, it has been referenced extensively in pop culture, especially hip-hop culture. There's also been comic books, television programs, and video games. At one point, rapper Snoop Dogg claimed to have watched the film once a month, every month, for a majority of his life. The film stayed number one at the British box office for three consecutive weeks from February 1984 to March of 1984, and it became the 15th highest grossing film in Britain in 1984. It was nominated for 3 Golden Globe Awards, Best Actor for Al Pacino, Best Supporting Actor for Stephen Bauer, and Best Score by Giorgio Moroder. And Scarface says the word fuck 226 times in total, and De Palma was said in 2001, an interview with in the Source magazine, that he was working on a sequel that would bring back Michelle Pfeiffer and star rapper Cuban Link, formerly of Terror Squad, as Tony's son and continuing the legacy of Tony Montana through his child. So her womb might have not have been as polluted as Tony Montana was led to believe.
I don't know what the odds of that sequel coming along, but I don't know.
But there was a sequel of sorts, Steve, because the video game version that I auditioned for as my first audition for William Morris, it tells the story that Tony survived this entire ordeal, was snuck out by some of his surviving people of his gang, and then came back to retake control of Miami. Stephen Bauer came back to voice a different character. And it was a success. The video game was a success for the time that it was released in the mid 2000s. All right, Steve, we're at that section after 4 parts of talking about this movie. We're at the final thoughts section. So Steve Morris, what are your final thoughts on 1983's Scarface?
So I think it's clear that if this were a show where Steve Morris was partnered with Steve Morris, we probably wouldn't have done, the two of us probably wouldn't have done Scarface. And I think that would have been a big loss for me. Because while I don't love the movie, it's not my favorite movie, I love film and I love interesting films. Al Pacino's performance is off the charts. There's so many great, great moments, great camera moves, interesting music, and the world is the world. And so it's like, you know what it is? It's like the thing, my son is not always that adventurous at trying new things, whether it's trying new food or going new places. And what I always am trying to teach him is like, the worst that happens is that you don't like those 2 hours, you know? But the thing is, you can't know if you're going to like it or you don't like it until you go. And sometimes, even if a movie isn't quite your movie or a meal isn't quite your meal, there's still amazing things to learn. And I feel like this has been a fantastic conversation. And I've learned, and it's really fun seeing the movie through your eyes. It's a really exciting thing. And the thing is, when Tony does say hello to my little friend and we get to that last moment, I'm like, fuck yeah, despite the fact there's some things in the movie that don't entirely work for me.
Yeah, I have to say my final thoughts are this. This has been such a blast to explore the movie through the context of the Cinephiles. You know, I've said this many, many times. The Cinephiles has changed how I look at movies, how I see movies, what I pay attention to, what stands out to me, what I'm catching. So much has changed in how I view movies nowadays because of this show. And this movie, I got to reappraise it in a completely different way than I had enjoyed the film in many, many years past. I got to see more of what De Palma was trying to do, really pay attention to cinematography, the score, the dialogue, the interactions, the pacing, the editing, so much about the movie. And it made me love the movie even more talking about it with Steve. Because nowadays, we're so caught in our silos. We're so defiant in our bubbles that we are, like, at times afraid to have our own opinions challenged. Afraid to walk in to say, like, I like this. Tell me why you didn't like it, though. And create space to hear the other side of it. And so I love it on the show when we don't always agree on a movie, because it leads to some fun conversations, some intelligent back and forth that I think hopefully leaves both of us thinking differently than when we went into the conversation about a movie. And I have to say this, again, defending my belief in the film, but also seeing Steve's points of view make me appreciate the film in a much more rounder way and make me love the film and believe what I love about the film even more, because I was challenged on it and I felt I was able to defend it from my point of view in a way that made sense for me. And so I love that about our four-part discussion on this movie, and it was great to revisit it. And I think, Steve, you pointed out some great things about Brian De Palma as a filmmaker that I hadn't quite put in context in my mind, but discussing this movie with you made it very clear to me what type of movies Brian De Palma really likes to make. And once again, as great as The Cinephiles is for you all to listen or get stuff from, me and Steve also get stuff from our own conversations. And that that to me means we've done some good work on a particular film, and Scarface qualifies for that. And so thanks for doing this with me, Steve, and thanks to everybody who put up with us talking about it for four parts, and we hope you enjoyed it.
Well, frankly, and I'll just speak for myself, we wouldn't have been making this show for 9.5 years if I didn't feel like I learned new things every week.
Yeah.
You know, I wouldn't be a satisfying show to do. Part of the excitement is that every week that we do this, I learn something new. And of course, we also learn from all of you. So why don't you visit us on our Facebook page? If you're a Facebook person, it's under The Cinephiles. It's Cine_Files on Twitter, The Cinephiles Podcast on Instagram. You can buy or stream Scarface along with every other film we've ever reviewed on cinephiles.net. If you want to support the show, we mentioned patreon.com/thecinephiles, as well as Apple Podcasts, where you can get ad-free versions of our show, as well as Cinephile Shorts. But on Patreon, you can also join our advisory board, who have the biggest voice in picking the films and the things that we do on this podcast. People often write to us and say, hey, is it okay if I suggest a movie? The answer is absolutely. You can suggest a movie anywhere, anytime, any place, but there are way more movies than we'll ever get to do. So if you really want to influence the movies we do on The Cinephiles, that's on the advisory board. And of course, if you want to reach me, it's at SR Morris on Twitter, SR Morris 1 on Instagram.
Yeah, and you can reach me at The Roca Says on all social media. And please check out my YouTube channel at youtube.com/John Roca Says. Thousands of you listen to us and you go into our YouTube channel at The Cinephiles. I would love for you all to come over and check out the content we do there on the John Roca channel as well. All right, Steve, that's it. We've done it. Scarface is over. Let's get out of here.
So I think that's it for this week. And I'm going to say, you know what? I can even tell you not only what our next movie is going to be, but it's actually going to come out in just a couple of days because things got a little compressed. And so Halloween is coming up. And for this year's scary movie, we are going to one of the most unusual horror movies ever filmed that had one of the most unusual marketing campaigns. And I actually think says a lot about our world today. And that is The Blair Witch Project, right on Halloween on The Cinephiles.